is magnified.
Do you ever go through a day where you feel like you did before you went to Iraq?
No. Ever since I came back, I've been so different as far as my demeanor. I was always an energetic person. I stay awake to the very last minute, maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep, and go right to work. I live out on Long Island. My commute is on a 406 train coming into Manhattan. And
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We'll continue to follow the story. And Juan, thanks so much for this explosive expose in the New York Daily News. Sergeant Agustin Matos, Sergeant Hector Vega, and Sergeant Herbert Reed. That does it for the program. I look forward to seeing folks at Lemoyne College in Syracuse tonight. And on August 13th, the launch of the Exception to the Rulers book and media tour will start in New York at Cooper Union at 7 o'clock. And you can call us at 212-431-9090. A very special thanks to Angie Karen, who started this investigation, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdulkadus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, commercial-free, KPFT, Houston.
Soulful eyes tell the story of loss. Cracked hands show the story of the long journey. Scarred faces reveal the story of hope. The tale of the refugee is told in stark black and white portraits featured in a PhotoFest exhibit at Interfaith Ministries for Greater Houston. The exhibit, by Interfaith Ministries volunteer and photographer Rodney Waters, is entitled Seeking Refuge. Each portrait is a powerful illustration of perseverance, survival, and hope. The Seeking Refuge exhibit is open to the public Wednesday through Friday, March 18th through April 8th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 3217 Montrose at Westheimer. For more information, call 713-533-4900. Whoa.
Welcome to Whole Mother. You are listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston. And this morning on Whole Mother, we will be interviewing Vicki Noble, author of The Double Goddess, Women Sharing Power. We're going to be speaking about archaeology, women, and the queens that once ruled humanity. But first, we have a poem here from Joanna Hill.
Ancient Mother, I hear you calling. Ancient Mother, I hear your song. Ancient Mother,
I am a wife. I am the earth. I am a sister. I've given birth. The power in my bicep complements the power of my calf, and yet the strength that I have used seems less than half. We may fight for our children, tooth and nail, as savage in our mercy and rage as any male. Why don't we scream louder, we women bought and sold, who underestimate ourselves? Do we believe what we are told? That lie of misdirection, that appearance is perfection. Tell me now, really, why do we let it pass that expectations are expected en masse? If my eyes were lined with gold and my knuckles made of brass, surely they would break into my house made of glass to tear me down in my wretched fight for my survivalist feminist right. Calling to the past, Susan, do you hear me? Was your maiden name Anthony? Did you resent the representation of your cause? Did your purity of purpose allow you to have flaws? I am one, an earth mother, sister, son. We women don't need countries. We women don't need flags. We don't need makeup or makeup bags. We need the truth. We need to be square with the other half of the race that places care on what we wear. Whether we are covered in jewels, feathers, or flair, whether we twist, braid, or cover our hair. We must see past religion's defenses. We must see that our worth is defined only by our actions, our hearts, our minds. They call us extreme. Why? Because we dream of something different? Because I may be crushed by the weight of my son and the wars he may fight that will never be won. We women don't need guns. We women don't need war. We women don't compete or keep score. We are united in spirit and softly padded hips. We are united in flesh, warm faces and smiling lips. The fight will continue. It will go on, it's true. We will burn and smolder for the few who may benefit from this might, this survivalist, feminist right.
Woman am I, spirit am I. I am the infinite within my soul. I have no beginning and I have no end. All this I am. Woman am I, spirit am I. I am the infinite within my soul. I have no beginning and I have no end. All this I am. Woman am I, spirit am I. I am the infinite within my soul. I have no beginning and I have no end. All this I am. Blessed am I, spirit am I. I am the infinite within my soul. I have no beginning and I have no end. All this I am. Blessed am I, spirit am I. I am the infinite within my soul. I have no beginning and I have no end. All this I am. Blessed am I, spirit am I. Infinite within my soul.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you're having a fabulous Monday. And we are here this morning with Vicki Noble, author of Double Goddess, Women Sharing Power. Vicki, are you on the line?
Yes.
Hi, it's so nice to talk to you finally.
Hi, thank you. It's so nice to be here.
Thanks so much. Well, let's get started with, obviously, the title is about goddesses, but let's talk about when we say double goddess, that we're actually talking about something physical as well as spiritual and all the other implications. But what are double goddesses?
Well, it started for me when I was traveling in the early 90s and teaching in Europe and in the Mediterranean and especially the British Isles, I guess, and Greece. And I started to see over and over again these double figurines that were in the museums. And no one had ever talked about them that I knew of. As it turns out, you know, when I go back to Maria Gimbutas' books and go back to some of the archaeology books, they are occasionally mentioned. But there was very little commentary about them, and as I was traveling, I saw so many of them that it blew me away. And I decided that, you know, we've already looked at the goddess cultures, those of us in the goddess movement and women's spirituality, for 25 years. We've been looking at ancient matrilineal and matristic mother-centered cultures where goddess worship was the norm and women were the priestesses and leaders in some way. But this was a very different kind of icon. And some of the figurines, they're usually small, not always, but normally they're small, even handheld figurines, but they show two women instead of one. And sometimes they share a pelvis, for instance, and their bodies grow separately out of that shared pelvis. Some of them have two heads. They're all different, excuse me, all different approaches to the same concept of these, what are they, you know, mother, daughter, sisters, something important. And I started to see that the more I looked, the more I found them. They were everywhere.
Well, let's talk about where everywhere is so that people can start to get an idea of the part of the world that we're talking about and also how far it spreads.
Uh-huh, that's good. The most important early goddess worshiping, or just the most important early civilizations in the Western world, are found in ancient Turkey. Probably the most familiar one for people is Çatalhöyük. It's the earliest city that we're familiar with, and so we're talking 7th millennium BC. I mean, this is 9,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the images from that site, which an archaeologist named Mellart dug in the 60s, the images are almost all female, very much predominantly female. There are wall paintings of goddesses in many different settings and many different postures, and a lot of them are doubles. Some of them are double images on the wall in beautiful colors in a kind of mirror image of one facing upwards and one facing downwards, and they're birth-giving goddesses in this mirror image. Very interesting, very beautiful and unusual, kind of like the way playing cards adapted that that doubling for the queens and kings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are figurines from that same culture. One of the most beautiful double goddess figurines comes from Çatalhöyük, and it is two women who share a pelvis and who wear one girdle or belt, and then two torsos grow up out of that, and they're embracing, two women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the breasts are clearly demarcated, so it's obvious that it's two women, and it's not at all clear who they are and what their function is. So mm-hmm. I started investigating, first of all, just from the premise that here are some amazing images of female bonding in some way. And I thought it could almost be a lesbian goddess. And lesbians haven't been very interested in the goddess movement as a whole, because it has seemed to focus so much on reproduction.
Right.
And so it's been a kind of a heterosexual model. And so that intrigued me. I thought that would be wonderful to bring forth a goddess image for lesbians. But of course, after I started to really investigate and search out all these different figures, I mean, there are 150 images just in my book.
Right.
And I'm sure there are many more to be discovered. I began to understand them in a larger context. It's still very much a female-centered context, which I think is about matriarchy and the early cultures having a social structure that we would really have to call matriarchal, even though people don't like that word and seem to want to replace it with other words. It actually means beginning with the mother, and it seems that these early cultures very definitely did begin with some concept of mother, daughter, and the whole idea of the genetics of our lineage being passed down through the mother-daughter line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and now, of course, we see that with the DNA research, you know, that the mitochondria is only passed through the female line, so all this searching out of our ancestry that they're doing is totally the same thing.
Yeah. I wanted to talk for a minute about what other mostly male archaeologists and scholars have said historically about these women figurines and the double goddess figurines and the, I guess, the kind of fight that you've had to say, you know, they're important.
Uh-huh. Well, in the early part of archaeology, up until about the 50s, really the classic archaeologists and historians had called the figurines goddesses, and they dealt with these cultures as goddess cultures. But what happened in Western archaeology as it rigidified into a discipline in the 50s is that they started to try to overturn that idea and to call them dolls and anything but goddess, to really question the idea that these were in any way religious, and how can we tell that, and so there's been a fight for 50 years, and I think the goddess movement really exacerbated that fight, because we took it really seriously as we discovered the goddess and the goddess cultures, these early peaceful cultures that were mainly all about female leadership. We got excited about that as a model
mm-hmm.
for peace on Earth, and as a model for how we might return to an ecological balance again. And so the disciplines in the academy, I think, became kind of threatened by that or something. And so the fight became almost like a culture war. And a lot of people don't even know this. You know, if you're not inside of it, I suppose you wouldn't even know. They just have tried to erase the work of the scholars like, even like Mellart, who dug at Chateauhouyuk. Now there are new archaeologists digging at Chateauhouyuk again, and they're really trying to say that the shrine rooms are not shrines and the goddesses are not goddesses.
And so what are they saying?
Oh, maybe they're dolls. We don't know. We can't know. They constantly say that. We can't know what they are.
So they're really trying to pass them, just pass by them, really.
Yeah.
And show no no importance.
Yeah, and it's tricky, you know. They have a beautiful visitor center they've built at Chateauhouyuk, and they have reproductions of many of the things they found at the site. And when you go in the visitor center, there is a reproduction that's up on the wall twice of one of the wall paintings or murals, and it happens to be, the one they've chosen happens to be featuring a bull, a very large bull painted in terracotta brown, and lots of mostly male figures dancing around the bull, maybe looking like hunters or something,
uh-huh.
and a few females. Well, that's the only image like that. And the site is, 90% at least of the images are intensely female
mm-hmm.
and sacred in that way, and they didn't use any of those images. It's very interesting. So how would you know?
Yeah.
You know, so it's, the bias is incredible.
Wow.
And then they also have a little flint knife in the visitor center in one of the displays, and this is from the 7th millennium, from Neolithic cultures that were absolutely peaceful. There's no evidence anywhere of any organized fighting or wars or anything like that. There's not even any evidence of any antagonism between the races or between men and women or anything like that. And so they've called this little flint knife, which is beautifully carved and probably belonged to a female shaman.
Right.
They've determined now that they had hunting and war. From this little tiny beautiful woman's knife.
Oh, know. My goodness.
Yeah, it's really, really horrible.
Wow.
Criminal.
Well, let's get more into the female aspect of all of this and start getting into something that you mentioned in your book is how our species, how important it is, and it's never talked about, that our species has moved away from the estrous cycle of course, bleeding whenever we're fertile.
Yeah.
And it's so, and you know, I've studied a lot of anthropology and getting into primatology and many things. And it's always wondered me that even when I read female primatologists, they're not talking about the importance of that and what that may mean for us.
I'm glad you got into that.
Yeah.
It seems incredibly important to me. But even as I looked at these figures, it took a long time to sort of arrive there, you know, because we're not used to thinking about it
right.
as anything important. And I've always been interested in the blood mysteries, and menstruation and ovulation and women's blood mysteries. But when I, at some point, it was like an epiphany. I realized, oh, the double goddess images are all about that. You know, that really we're looking at a kind of a template of some way that our early ancestors conceptualized the cosmology that they were living inside of. And they really conceptualized human evolution, I think, through these double goddess figures. And I believe, like the earliest one is from the Paleolithic times, you know, maybe 30,000 years ago. And it is one of those mirror images like the ones that are found later in the murals. And it's carved on a cave wall. And it appears to be, you know, a woman on the top facing up and another woman on the bottom facing down. And they wondered, was it a birth scene or what, you know, but they've decided that, or at least some scholars have decided that it is a double goddess figure. And I believe it's like a calendar, winter solstice, summer solstice, you know, day and night. And that it's multi-leveled, of course, in its symbolism.
Sure.
And that finally it represents this amazing thing that happened to us as humans, which is that we left the estrus cycle behind in some way, and we synchronized with the moon. And no other species has done that. Even our very close relatives, the chimps and the bonobo monkeys, they neither one of them, even though our DNA is amazingly similar, I believe we're 98% the same.
Yes.
And yet each of those species has retained estrus, so they bleed or show a little blood when they are fertile, and that's a signal to the male, and then they reproduce, and so that any sexual activity is directly connected with reproduction. For humans, of course, it's this amazing thing that we did. We went bipolar. We joined with the moon in some way, and even the words, the early words, you know, for moon are the same as for mind. And
interesting.
So there's some way that we understand, even through our linguistic structures, that this was a very amazing evolutionary moment for the human race, that somehow when we started to be sexually receptive as females during our ovulation and signaled to the male through some pheromones or whatever, but not blood, and then had our bleeding time at the other end of the cycle with the dark moon, that changed everything. And that has been so little explored that I don't even think we know, you know, can know really at this point what it might have changed. But I assume that it has a lot to do with our tool making capacities and our language skills and the things that make us really fundamentally different or unique.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a most important thing. It has to do with the female biology. As far as I can tell, and I've studied this for many years, that all the early female shamanism and the early religious structures in our societies came out of social organization that recognized the sacredness of this cycle and that celebrated the new moon and the full moon, and in that way celebrated women's cycles. And women as priestesses, of course, were embodying the ovulation and the menstruation. So the whole vibration of our bodily fluids and so on, which has been very well documented by people like Rupert Sheldrake and morphogenetic fields and all of that vibrational energy was harnessed by the culture in early rituals, which were centrally facilitated by women, but not in any, it's not in an ego kind of way, you know.
Right.
It's just the whole female group in its biological capacities would have would have held the rituals that would have kept the community sane, and probably is the ultimate reason why there was peace on Earth for such a long time.
Interesting. Well, let's start getting into the destruction of the goddess and start talking about Amazons.
Uh-huh, good. Yeah, I like to think that I actually got this idea from a Marxist writer on Amazon.
Oh, how interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and he said, I mean, many of the historians had written that the Amazons ruled in dual queenship, but this Marxist writer, Immanuel Kant, writing in the early part of the 20th century, said there could not be Amazons without patriarchy. You know, there had to be this, the Amazons didn't exist because there was no war, and so there were no women warriors. But once patriarchy or male domination began to spread, and these invasions and different forms of colonization began to occur, and the matriarchal structures were overturned. That's really the important key. It's not just that men were abusive to women. I think that did finally happen. But in the beginning, I really think it was more of a social structural change from matriarchy to male domination. And when you do that, you change everything. And so linguists have recently told us that the word Amazon, which people used to believe it meant those without breasts, you know, so then they dreamed up this whole idea that Amazons burnt off one breast of the baby girls and stuff like that. And none of that is true.
Oh,
there's no evidence at all for anything like that, either in the iconography or the burials. And the word Amazon, they've now determined, means no husband, no husband one. So the Amazons are really, I think, not at all about all female tribes, but really about remnant tribes of matriarchal cultures, matriarchal civilizations or structures that where there actually aren't any husbands or fathers. It's hard to imagine for us.
It is.
There are some living matriarchal cultures that I learned about last September at a matriarchy conference in Luxembourg, the first international conference on matriarchy. There will be more.
Well, we certainly will want to hear about that.
Yeah, I think the next one will actually be in the States, and it might be in Texas. Actually.
Well, hello.
Yeah, so I'll let you know.
Yes.
But it was so illuminating to learn that there are living cultures that still define themselves as matriarchal, because, you know, that's been one of the big myths in anthropology, that there are no living matriarchal cultures, so you can't say there ever was such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now these cultures have been studied, and actually at this conference, not only did we hear about some Indonesian groups that are matriarchal, but there was an Algerian Berber woman, Kabile Berber, who spoke about her tribe as being matriarchal and told us about the mother-centered structure. And then there were several anthropologists who spoke about the Muso in southern China. And then a man from that culture who spoke to the group was just fascinating and told us about the living structure and how it works. And there are, you know, because there's no marriage structure, men grow up living in their mother's extended family, and their productive labor returns to her. I mean, they do their work at her house. They go in the night and visit their lovers at their mother's homes, but they come back in the morning and continue to live with their mothers, or you know, not like we think in a nuclear family, but they live in the mother house,
mm-hmm.
in the extended family. And the girls are free to entertain lovers as they please. And there are no illegitimate children, there are no single mothers, you know, it doesn't even exist. There are no husbands and no fathers. They just pay no attention to that. And the mother's brother, when a girl has children, when she grows up and has babies, her brother is the male figure who is responsible to those children. So it all happens in the same household, and it's really... And this is current.
Wow.
And during Mao's revolution, they tried to erase it by forcing the Mosso to marry. But after the the Cultural Revolution was over in China, then the Mosso have gone back to their old customs as much as they can. And he also spoke about the young people who leave the culture to explore, you know, the larger culture in China or whatever, and that they mostly come back because they find that it's so rough, and that the marriage customs and the patriarchal structure is basically so unpleasant and so non-nurturing that they come back home to make their lives in the old way. It was fascinating.
Very fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's get back to Amazons and how women were forced, I guess, kind of underground.
Well, exactly.
So to speak.
As these beautiful, I mean, they seem almost idyllic, you know, from our standpoint, these early civilizations with all their beautiful art and ritual and so on. And as they were disrupted and overthrown, there was a lot of movement, for one thing, a lot of migration, and you see different remnant cultures showing up in different places. And some of the strongest double goddess cultures are in Turkey, but later, not in the 7th millennium anymore, more like the 3rd millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of double goddesses from that period and in that place, and also nearby, like northern Syria, and in the Cycladic Islands, in the Aegean and the Mediterranean area. Also, Malta is an important place. It's between Sicily and Africa in the Mediterranean. And in the 4th millennium, there were double goddess images in Malta that are very important. So there's this continuation and apparent movement of people trying to get out of the way, basically, and trying to retain their culture, and I'm sure that that's where Amazons comes from. I'm assuming that the neighboring tribes of any matriarchal culture would have perceived them as no husband ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the name would have arisen from the differentiation, because they were so distinctly different from the male dominant cultures like the Scythians and so on, who live next door to the Sarmatians. This is all in my book. You know, if people aren't interested in the details of the archaeology, they can just kind of read for the story. But those people who love history and geography and archaeology will find that it's just amazing how these themes repeat. So Amazon queens were founding cities in Turkey in the 3rd and 2nd millennium. Many cities are named for them. For instance, Ephesus,
mm-hmm,
named for Ephesia. And there's a city named Marina on the island of Lemnos, and so on. There are lots of cities named for Amazons. And apparently, they kept moving and kept fighting back and developed not just the concept, the actual women warrior. And then much later, the women warriors are found in burials along the Don and the Volga rivers and other places in Russia and out in the steppes. And you really see the double goddess theme in these burials, because the women are warriors, and then some of them are priestesses, and they're buried with special artifacts and things that define that division of labor. And for people who want to read about that in more than just my book, Janine Davis Kimball is the archaeologist who first started to dig with the Russians about 10 years ago, and brought forth a lot of this really amazing material on the Amazons.
Wonderful.
The Russians have actually been digging up these burials of Amazons for 50 years. We just didn't know it. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, it is.
And they've never had an edge against calling them Amazon.
Uh-huh.
They've always assumed that these were the Amazons that Herodotus was writing about in the 5th century B.C.
Of course.
It's the Western archaeologists that have the bias and have tried to keep that, you know, they don't use words like Christus.
Right.
And they don't use words like Amazon. But Janine Davis Kimball did and does, and it has really made world headlines.
We're speaking with Vicki Noble, author of The Double Goddess, Women Sharing Power. The next thing I'd like to get into is the women sharing power part.
Uh-huh.
And how, you know, maybe we can go into how we could use that today.
Yeah, I like to think it's a role model.
Yeah.
You know, collaborative work is something that has happened a lot in the women's movement. And in my last chapter, I tried to mention a few of the women that I've been familiar with, you know, who have worked in collaborative ways to start important clinics and other institutions of the women's movement. For instance, will I be able to think of their names? Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. They began a women's clinic in San Francisco, well, such a long time ago, 30 years ago, I think. And they've actually been partners for an equally long time, maybe even 40 years. And they just got married in San Francisco during the big marriage.
How wonderful.
Isn't that great?
Yes, yes.
I mean, they didn't just get married. They were the first ones.
Oh!
So it was such a beautiful resolution of their long life together and how much they mean in terms of female leadership in the women's movement, because mm-hmm. they've just been so... such models, you know, of Amazons. And so I do feel that the collaborative model of female leadership is very important for us, and it's kind of natural. I think there's some way that this, the historians talked about the Amazons as having a war queen and a domestic queen. You have to kind of, flesh that out a
yeah.
little bit. And so I like to think of it as, there was a temporal queen and a spiritual queen, or somebody who would take care of the more domestic kinds of concerns, and then someone else who would be relating more to the invisible spirit world and some of the religious concerns. Not that they were separate.
Right.
But just that there would be maybe even that there's a kind of a natural tendency in one or the other of those directions. And to use the menstrual cycle as a model, it's kind of like day and night, or conscious and non-rational, normal daily activity, and then the sacred invisible activities of trance and dreaming and things like that. So I think that's a good way to think about it, and then sort of figure out when we pair up as partners in business or in life, who's holding which pole, and how would we describe that? What does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in lesbian parlance, the butch femme archetype has probably carried some of that.
Right.
But carries some of that warrior priestess kind of archetype. But again, I think we can flesh that out in a much richer way, and we don't have to be limited by a gender stereotype.
Wow. What was the next thing I wanted to cover? Mm-hmm. I wanted to go into how we feel, or how you feel that, just reading through some of the history in your book, what exactly physically took place, and what were some of the last places where dual queenships were occurring?
Uh-huh. Well, I suppose, there was this long, there's a long process, and so much of it is missing
sure.
from history.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my work is this obsessive effort to put the woman back into history.
Yes.
And I've sort of tracked it. I can see that the the agricultural societies were broken down, as Maria Gimbutas and other archaeologists have showed us. They were broken down in waves, and so until the fourth millennium, there was really pretty intact civilizations that were peaceful and agricultural. And then as they began to be disrupted, they started moving around and changing, and there are amalgams in all these different places. And by the third millennium, between 3000 and 2000 BC, in other words, is when you really start to see chieftains. That's the way they describe it, chieftains. So then you have to do some shape-shifting with your mind in order to get around the female aspect, because really what we're seeing in the artifacts is two women over and over. There aren't male images still from that period. You know, the male images show up later. So we're really looking at cultures that were still deifying or reifying in some way these two women. And then and so in Turkey, I don't know of any burials actually that have two women or have the differentiation. I only know of the figurines. And so we're really working from artifacts and assuming that the stories that Homer told in the 8th century about the Amazons and the later historians, even from the 5th century BC, who talked about the Amazons ruling in dual queenship, we know that they were talking about a much earlier period, either early in the second millennium after 2000 BC or even earlier. And I prefer to think that the third millennium was really the heyday of the Amazon queens, because the Cycladic Islands show such a strong matriarchal presence, and the places in Turkey, what they show has changed from the ancient agricultural societies where everyone was egalitarian. Now we see high-ranking females with buried with gold and really fancy stuff, you know, crowns and headdresses and fabulous jewelry and things like that. And you see that in the third millennium a lot, and you see it even more in the second millennium, especially in the Mediterranean area and around the Black Sea. And then finally, in the Iron Age, when Herodotus was writing about the Scythians and the Amazons, at that point is when these burials that Janine Davis Kimball has been unearthing and studying, that's when they take place. And that's when you really see the division of labor so clearly, the priestesses and the warriors. So that's the last point that I actually know of where there's any physical evidence like that of the two types, and that there was at least a memory in the culture and still within the structure of this earlier female leadership. Probably by that time it was somewhat in question, but still some of the tribes from the 5th century BC were definitely Amazons, and meaning that they were not male-dominated and that they did not have patriarchal marriage structures. And then you see these intermarriage patterns. You see Scythian kings being buried with indigenous priestesses. And so then you start to see the way the colonization took place. When the incoming tribes were male dominant, they would create marriage with these, which, you know, is a form of colonization at that point. It's not romantic.
Right.
And so that's the way that the queen would have been colonized. And you see this in many places and in many different time periods. It's one of the things I'm trying to research now. And the other really interesting thing about that is that the all the accoutrements, the paraphernalia of the priestess and the warrior, was later kind of transferred intact onto the bride. So I think this intermarriage thing is very important, because today, in many of these places, they still have their folk dress, you know?
Right.
And especially the brides still get married in these ancient costumes. And so much of what they wear in many of these places is what the priestesses and the warrior women are buried with, you know, from 2,000 years earlier.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That really is, it's even though the women don't know what they're carrying on.
Yeah. I thought, well, no wonder we all want to get married. We all want our day to be the goddess.
That's great. Wow. Well, let's go ahead and bring this over to North America. And talk about maybe some of the sites, the few sites I see on the map in North America where we find ancient goddess cultures. And I have to say, when I saw this, I was confused because I was under the impression that many more North American tribes were matrilineal. Do we know that, or do we just not have proof?
Yeah, I think that's pretty well known. In terms of my maps, it's mostly just that I was looking specifically for double goddesses.
Okay.
And there actually are some double female figures in South America and in Mexico.
Right. Yeah, that's where I wanted to...
Yeah, and they're equally interesting. I mean, they look the same. Most of them are two-headed, but not all. And so they look a little like Siamese twins or something.
Uh-huh.
And they look very much like the old European ones from some of the sites in the Balkans and stuff from the 5th millennium B.C. But these Mexican figures are more like, maybe at the earliest 1500 B.C.
Hmm.
And they were found, they're little clay figurines, and they were found mostly, I think, in farmers' fields. So they may have been part of the general so-called fertility
right.
kind of thing that goes with the agricultural communities. And then in Peru, there are some double female figures, and I think maybe even Ecuador. So that's very interesting. You know, this double thing, it's definitely more than just a Western or an old European concept.
Wasn't strictly centralized to that area.
Right. But I don't really know of any so far in North America. It'd be very interesting if there were.
Right.
But certainly the Native American cultures, and I tried to deal with this a little bit in my last chapter by talking about the concept of the two-spirit woman, which is a Native American concept. They have a whole idea of the third gender that that researchers have been working with recently in the last maybe 10 years and studying from Native American culture, from all different Native American tribes. And there seems to be a kind of widespread, I don't know what you would call it, an appreciation that not everyone falls into the two
heterosexual categories.
We're just so rigid about our sexual stereotypes. It's so funny. We act like they're biological.
Right.
And of course, in a certain way, there's, you know, female genitalia and male genitalia and so on. But in terms of the range of appearance and behavior, you know, we know there's quite a spectrum. And so in Native American cultures, they did a very interesting thing, which I think must be true all over the world, and we're just seeing it in Native American cultures as a kind of a remnant,
right.
Which is that they have a division of labor. You know, the women do the communal cooking and the men do the communal hunting, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So then if somebody as a child begins to kind of reach outside of their sex role, the boy reaches for more female kinds of activities and the girl reaches for more male kinds of activities, they just integrate that. It's no problem. So they just teach the girl how to be a warrior, and she takes a wife and, you know, becomes the chief. And they do the same thing with the boys. They teach them, they just let them grow up with the women, and they, in some cases, they have maybe a first initiation with the boys, but then after that they don't take the second initiation. Instead, they move into the women's community, and they may dress like a woman, and many of them, this is usually known as the burdash, and they're shamans. And they've been described for centuries in the anthropological literature in Siberia and so on, and some of the Eskimo stuff, and it's always been kind of this exotic, weird thing. But it's much more widespread than that, and it's actually just a way of continuing to keep the very functional division of labor in the society so that everything continues, the tradition continues.
Sure, and so that everyone is actually happy and not trying to fit into a mold that they just don't care to.
Exactly. There's really quite a lot more individual freedom of expression than we've believed mm-hmm. about communal societies. Really more individual freedom of expression than in our own society in a certain way.
Of course. Well, something that was interesting was I brought this book home, and my husband and I started looking at it, and he started reading it while I'm folding laundry. And he starts looking at it, and he's like, oh, what? What? And my husband is an extremely open-minded person and may qualify as even more of a feminist than I am. But he does all my research for my show. So he's looking at it, and he's like, I can't see it. I don't see it, you know, as he's reading the beginning of the book. And then as he starts getting into it, he's like, oh, okay, I can maybe see it. I can maybe visualize that that's what this is. And two, also, when I first opened the beginning of the book and you start looking at what you're calling double goddess figurines, I'm like, well, that's just like a two-headed flask. That's all that is. And then you start
what?
A two-headed flask or, you know, a drinking gourd with two pipes on it, you know. And so then you start reading a little bit further and you go, oh, okay. And if you look at where the figurines evolved to and then go backwards, you can definitely see the, you know, the very beginnings of the double goddess figurines.
Yeah.
But the other thing that comes into our emotional beings is just that you don't want to believe that it's there.
Uh-huh.
And I found that very interesting for both my husband and I, who are very, you know, this is what we do, is feminist work. And
yeah,
and
you're actually open, and still you have
and
resistance.
Still there's that resistance there. So I just thought you might want to touch on that a little bit.
Well, you know, I think the whole, I think when I talk about the Amazons as no husband ones and try to present it as a model of matriarchal social structures, I think people get pretty freaked out too. I think we covet the fantasy and the romantic dream of the sacred male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but it's kind of rigidified these days into this marriage thing. And it's, you know, you have to think that it's pretty funny on one level, not funny haha, but funny in a kind of big philosophical way, that the movements of the 60s that were so disruptive to traditional structures really did break the marriage structure. And what's happening now, everybody everywhere seems like they're still racing to get married, and we love the form. We're in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
We hold it very high as an archetypal form. But the truth is that we broke the form, and we're suffering the results of that right now in the kind of instability of it all. And, you know, I believe in the United States now, the statistics are that half the marriages fail, but mm-hmm. in California, 75% of marriages end in divorce.
Mm.
And so really we're shifting the model without even taking responsibility for it, you know, without even really getting aligned with it. The model has shifted.
That's a mind-blowing way to look at it.
Well, it's a very interesting thing. I tell my young students, you know, who want to have babies and who are trying to figure out how to do that with these fluctuating male-female relationships,
mm-hmm.
and I think that young women would really benefit by bonding together around their living situations and making a contract with one another to set up a stable structure in which they can have their babies and raise their babies to a certain extent, at least for 10 years, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And the men can come and go, because actually that's what they do statistically.
It's true.
And that's what they are allowed to do and supported to do in a matriarchal structure. They're not expected to pair bond for life. You know, maybe a few do, but it's unusual. Basically, there's a much more sophisticated recognition of people's need for sexual expression in many different ways. And so in a matriarchal setting, and even if we created one now, let's say three young women decide to move into a house together in their early 30s so that they can get pregnant and have their babies and support one another and raise the children together in a stable state. And all three of them might do it differently. One might have a male partner that is her partner for life. Another one might have no male partner. You know, one of them could be a lesbian. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Because they're all doing it that way now anyway. You know, if a woman, there are so many single mothers now.
Yes.
And this would be a way of really recognizing that and not freaking out over it.
Right.
I've just been trying to encourage us to be more neutral about the template and acknowledge that there are different formulas for success. And the marriage formula doesn't seem to be the predominant successful model at this point, although, of course, you know, there are people who are managing to succeed at it, one out of four,
right,
in California. So it's one model, but not the only one.
That's really interesting. Let's we're going to have to wrap it up shortly. We're almost out of time. You've been listening to Whole Mother, and we've been speaking with Vicki Noble, author of The Double Goddess, Women Sharing Power. Vicki, what do you want to leave us with?
Well, I'd like everybody to know about a new organization. I'm on the board of the Red Web Foundation, and we had a conference last spring to initiate the foundation, and now we have a 501c3 and are trying to get funding. And it's an organization to create a structure for networking and for pulling together all the women all over the world, really, who are doing work in the field with young women, teaching them about their menstruation, celebrating rituals, and creating literature to help mothers and daughters know how to really sacralize the menstrual cycle so that everybody won't have PMS. So on. So keep your ears open and
definitely. And how can we find out more information about you or the Red Web Foundation?
Well, you can go to my website, motherpeace.com, and there you'll see everything that I have been doing, and also that Karen Vogel, my co-creator of Mother Peace, all her projects as well. And you can the Red Web Foundation is just getting a website up, so
okay,
within a month or so, you can go there, too.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for being with us today, Vicki. This has been a very interesting interview.
Thank you
and,
so much.
And I'd encourage people to definitely look at The Double Goddess, Women Sharing Power, and hopefully incorporate it somehow into our current lives.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.